Confession of Faith, Chapter 23 of the Civil Magistrate, Section 2. It is lawful for Christians to accept and execute the office of a magistrate when called thereunto, in the managing whereof, as they ought especially to maintain piety, justice, and peace, according to the wholesome laws of each commonwealth, so for that end they may lawfully now, under the New Testament, wage war upon just and necessary occasion. There are several things about this section that we need to observe. The first is that it's lawful for a Christian to be a magistrate. There are a number of groups over the years who've objected to this, particularly Anabaptists, and so we're going to answer that question. We're going to respond to that objection. We do not believe that there's something inherently wrong with being a magistrate. As Reformed Presbyterians, we have objections to the constitution of magistracy in the United States and in other countries, but that is an objection to a particular constitution of magistracy, not the concept or the office of a magistrate. So what is lawful for us to do does not mean it's always lawful for us to do in all cases, in all circumstances, and so on. So anyway, we're going to look at the question of the lawfulness of accepting the office, executing the office, and we'll have reason to talk about some of the objections that we might have in this case, the situation in which we now live. And certainly the situation wherein the Reformed Presbyterians and Covenanters found themselves after there were a number of emendations to the British Constitution, and particularly as it entered into the so-called Glorious Revolution. In executing the office of a magistrate, there needs to be a managing of that office, and that managing is to maintain piety, justice, and peace. Those are the duties. We're going to talk briefly about this. It actually is going to be something that we get a lot more, coming under a lot more discussion in the next section of the confession, where we talk about the magistrate's power with respect to the church and also with suppressing blasphemy and other kinds of sins that happen also to be crimes or should be crimes, sins against the first table of the law. You know, very often, and we'll talk about this more next time, but very often we see general consensus that the second table of the law regarding man's duty to man, that laws being made to enforce that, people have no problem with that, or they generally don't have a problem with, you know, laws. At least we are trimming away at the edge of that now, but generally there has been consensus that these are proper proper objects for the magistrate to enforce and to punish the breaches. It's much more controversial when we talk about the first table of the law, but that's something we're going to allude to this time. Next time is really when that will get its discussion, so I don't want to get too far into that this time, because I know that we'll have time to talk about that, and there's a lot to talk about there. Nonetheless, I do want to point out that the doctrine of the magistrate states it is the duty in managing the office of magistrate, Christians are to maintain piety, justice, and peace. And so there's a problem here. Then if we have a constitution of government, it's not going to allow you to maintain piety, justice, and peace. If the laws are contrary to piety, the laws are contrary to justice, the laws are contrary to peace, any of these would be sufficient. And to some extent, I think we can say that all of these are very difficult to maintain under the present constitution of government in most Western democratic countries, if not all of them. So we'll, you know, I'm going to talk about that a little bit there as well. The big question is the last question that we're going to be talking about, and that is this idea of waging of war. And it's not that Christianity is teaching that people are supposed to be waging war on any occasion. It's not that all war is a legitimate undertaking, but it is the fact that some war is just and necessary. So the confession really is upholding what has been called the just war theory and has been clearly enunciated and defended for in the Christian church at least as far back as Augustine. Now, that theory has been misused and abused, but again, we're talking about the theory of just war. We're not saying any more than when we talk about the magistrate. We're talking about the theory of the magistrate. We're not saying that every magistrate is lawful and just, nor are we saying that every opportunity to accept and execute the office of magistrate is lawful and just, any more than every war or most wars, in fact, that are undertaken are lawful and just. You know, don't confuse the two. It's a serious mistake to confuse the two. Right? To confuse the providence of God with the precept of God is to lose all sense of moral direction. It's to lose that moral compass that we have both in natural moral law, but more importantly, as those who've been favored with the light of special revelation, that which we find in the Bible. Because what the Bible teaches regarding natural moral law not only confirms that natural moral law, but it clarifies and it defines. It actually helps us understand the space in which, in this case, lawful, just war is permitted. We can't go to war over everything. Not every offense between nations should be viewed as a just or necessary occasion for war. And we're not going to explore the just war theory in all of its details. The purpose today is not to get into all of the possibilities. We'll probably talk about some. Probably have to address some examples. But we're just not going to be exhaustive, because that is a subject which, quite frankly, could engage a lot of discussion and a lot of thought just in its own right. We could probably spend weeks going over that. So, what we're going to be, what we're intending to do is to defend this idea that it is lawful for a Christian, as a magistrate, to wage war when it is just and necessary. And I would emphasize that the confession says just and necessary. You know, not every case where justice has been violated is it necessary. And not every case where it seems to be necessary is it just. In fact, I think if we were to consider the case of just war or necessary war, the one indication that you have a just war, clear indication, would be that you're waging defensive war and not offensive war. You know, that's one thing I think that we could say right off the top, that there is a right to deflect that kind of evil falling in when we understand the role of the magistrate. The magistrate has to maintain peace. Well, how do you maintain peace, you know, when war has been declared against you? You have to fight back sometimes. So that's certainly one way that we can be sure that we're not entering into or engaging ourselves in something which is unjust. Right. Now, again, there are all kinds of ancillary questions that could be raised. Some of these questions are actually dealt with, at least with regard to the doctrine of the magistrate, they're dealt with in more detail in our Act, Declaration, and Testimony, because the Reformed Presbyterian Church was forced to defend a position that I don't really think ought to require that much defense. This idea that the magistrate is to rule in the fear of God and ought to rule according to the law of God. But since we have more than a few people who think that providential possession of power is enough to make one a legitimate magistrate, then, you know, we have to deal with that question. We have to answer some of the objections that they try to raise from the confession and from the Bible. All right. Let's begin with the first question then. Is it lawful for a Christian to accept and execute the office of a magistrate when called thereunto? And the answer is yes. We begin with Proverbs 8, 15 and 16, and Romans 13, 1, 2, and 4.
Proverbs 8, verses 15 and 16. By me kings reign and princes decree justice. By me princes rule and nobles, even all the judges of the earth.
Romans 13, verses 1, 2, and 4, verses 1 and 2. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God, the powers that are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. In verse 4, for he is the minister of God to thee for good, but if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil.
Okay, so what we can say from that is the Anabaptists are maintaining that it's not lawful for Christians to carry the office of a magistrate. If it were simply unlawful, then there would be no point, particularly in the passage in Romans, but also in Proverbs, you know, the idea that by me kings reign. Now, again, this needs to be understood. Proverbs is wisdom literature. So when the Bible says, by me kings reign, I think there are a couple of things that we need to take into account. It's not simply a matter of stating the obvious, and that is that all things that fall out in time happen by the providence of God. We know that. We've already confessed that in our confession. That adds nothing to our discussion here. But by me, kings reign, it's by the wisdom, and in fact, this is wisdom personified. This is Christ speaking in Proverbs. By Christ, kings reign. That is to say that if they're not ruling according to Christ, if they're not doing what he would have done, they're not really reigning. It's really just a usurpation. There's no legitimacy in what they're doing. They're not following the moral law of God. They're violating the moral law of God. You can't find in that anything more than a providential usurpation. That is, just like God permits sin. You know, he does not approve sin. He's not the author or approver of sin, but he certainly allows it. He permits it in his providence. He certainly in his providence empowers creatures to sin. Because if the Spirit were to take away the breath of any creature, they would return to the dust. By me kings reign. That is, without Christ, they're not really reigning. What are they doing? It's something else altogether. You can't find legitimacy here in providential possession of office. That's not wherein true reigning is said to consist. True reigning, true rule, is ruling according to what Christ has revealed. And the powers that be are ordained of God. The higher powers. And the word higher there, it refers to moral. It's referring to a moral superiority. It's not, they're not just simply a hierarchy. But when it's used in conjunction with exousia, hooper exousia, it's talking about a higher authority that is moral. Now, the idea that this is a plea on the part of the Apostle Paul to submit unthinkingly to whatever is going on is absolute foolishness. In fact, it is to inculcate in a people a wicked passive obedience, a wicked subjection to a usurpation and misuse of what God has ordained to be for the good of his people and for the suppression of what is really evil. You know, is Paul talking about Nero or someone like that in Romans 13? I strongly doubt it, because John in the Apocalypse says that of the Roman government that they derive their exousia, their authority, from the dragon, from the devil. Are Paul and John at odds? I know we can't begin with John and move to Paul. We have to move from Paul to John, but John is John's statement has to be reconciled with what Paul is saying. What do you do with the apostles' actions when, in the book of Acts, he's brought into the hall of the high priest? And the high priest says, smack him, smite him. And Paul says, God smite thee, thou whited wall. And the high priest says to him, don't you know who you're talking to? I'm the high priest. And Paul says, if I'd known that, I wouldn't have spoken as I did, because Moses says in the law, thou shalt not speak evil to the rulers of the people. Now, was Paul just a walking, talking moron? He's in the hall of the high priest, where they have a throne at the end of the hall, whereupon the only person who is allowed to sit is the high priest. And the man sitting in that throne is speaking to him and says, God, or it says to the guard, smite him. Does Paul know nothing? I mean, I thought he was a Pharisee. Pharisee's Pharisee. Someone who was punctilious in the keeping of the law. Who knew and understood all of these fine distinctions within the Mosaic ceremonies. So that he could catch Christians and hail them away and bring them to justice. What's happened here in this hall? All of a sudden he's become stupid, he was converted, and now he's got amnesia? Or perhaps what Paul is really saying is, you know, just because you're sitting there doesn't mean you're the authority of God. Just because you're sitting there in that throne, you have providential possession, does not mean you have a preceptive right to rule. And the fact that you have just tried to enforce something contrary to justice, that alone is a dead giveaway that you only occupy that throne by the providence of God and not by the precept of God. So no, Mr. Pretended High Priest, I didn't say anything evil about the rulers of the people, because the fact is, you're not really the ruler of the people of God. It has to be different if a Christian occupies the office of a magistrate. It's not that there's something inherently wrong with magistracy. God has very clearly established it, and established it for a purpose. Just like God has established marriage for a purpose. But you know, if you misuse marriage and turn it into a venue for whoredom, then you know, you've violated that too. Your marriage is illegitimate when you do a number of things that violate the ends and purposes of marriage. And we'll get into that in the next chapter. That's a hint for anyone who thinks that birth control is okay within the bonds of marriage. And any kind of activity outside of marriage, as we'll see, is just plain rank fornication. So it's not an option. But that's for another time. The fact is, you can take away the lawfulness of that institution through not just one act, but through a, as the covenanters point out, a habitual series of acts. A magistrate doesn't become illegitimate because he sins. But habitual acts of tyranny, habitual acts of injustice, habitual acts that are contrary to piety, habitual disposition in the office contrary to any of these, is enough to make that exercise illegitimate. And it would not comport with a Christian to bear office in that way. So if they have a bunch of laws that are going to constrain you to behave, to take oaths contrary to the Word of God, to enact laws, enforce laws contrary to the Word of God, you can't do it. You can't. You just simply can't. But the Anabaptists are wrong to deny that magistracy is lawful for Christians. You know, again, Anabaptists generally think that magistracy exists in the world simply because of sin, which is wrong. You know, it's very wrong to think that that's the only reason for it to be here. There is a need, as I've said before, for order. Even if there were no problem of sin, even if there were no crimes that were going to be committed, because men weren't sinners by nature, they would still need leadership. They would still need order. They would still need some kind of direction when it came to the interactions of societies. There would still be need from time to time for different kinds of arbitration. Not necessarily those kinds of arbitration that arise because of the sinful lusts of men or anything else like that, but simply because of the need for order. There would need to be order. The Anabaptists are confuted for the following reasons. First of all, because there is no power but of God, the powers which are ordained of God. Again, Romans 13, verse 1.
Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God.
Powers that be are ordained of God. That is, anything that really is a power, an authority, is ordained of God. That does not mean that that power being exercised in an unlawful manner is of God. You know, to the degree and to the extent that it is exercised in a fashion contrary to the law of God, it's not a power ordained of God. Now, that already differences, say, the institution of a family and family government from civil government. Right? Family government involves a natural ordering, and it is a bond, an unbreakable bond, because it's founded in nature and is organic. And it does not depend upon the same kinds of things that are necessary for the constitution of a civil magistrate. We actually have things that God has said that are required of magistrates in order for them to be magistrates. Right? We have things that are commanded of fathers, not in order to be fathers, but simply as fathers, they're being told they need to do this. It's not a matter of constituting them fathers in the way that it is constituting a magistrate. There's a difference. There is a voluntariness involved in government that is not involved in family. God sets a solitary in families. Right? You don't get to choose your parents. It's true, you don't get to choose the country into which you're born, but you do get to choose whether or not you're going to obey God rather than man when it comes to what this magistrate is commanding. And while you have that in the case of family, in the case of family, the discretion of the father in the family is much broader than with the state. The state doesn't have this broad discretionary power that is available to the family. Right? The state doesn't have the right to tell you what time to get up in the morning, what time to go to bed. It doesn't have the right to tell you, you know, what you're going to eat for dinner. Your parents do. So it's much broader. It's also much more local and much more limited, because any parental authority is inherently limited to the children that they have. In the case of a magistrate, there's a much broader construction. So for them to be ordained of God, to be moral authorities, the higher powers that God has ordained them to be, they have to rule, they have to be just men ruling in the fear of God. And that's what David says, they have to be just men. He that ruleth must rule in the fear of God. Be just men ruling in the fear of God. Right? The office of magistrate is not in and of itself objectionable. But men can take that because it's a voluntary assumption on their part. They can take that and they can twist that. All right. You can twist being a father to a degree, but only to a degree. Because there is inherent in that relation certain responsibilities and certain duties that don't really exist when we're talking about a magistrate, because a magistrate can, in fact, decline to be a magistrate. A father can't cease to be a father. And so you can't, in the case of a magistrate, you can separate the person from the office. But once someone's a father, you can't. And that's one reason why we can make these distinctions, and why you cannot argue from parity of case. Just because both are founded in nature does not mean that both are equally extensive in their right to command or in the obligation which they entail. Right, second, because Solomon says, by me, that is by the Lord, kings reign and princes decree justice. Again, Proverbs 8:15,
by me kings reign and princes decree justice.
And that tells you that, in fact, although, as James Renick said, a magistrate is not a magistrate as a Christian, but as a man, nonetheless, only a Christian man will really be able to undertake and fulfill that office in all of its obligations and with respect to all of its duties. Right? It's not going to be something that can be fulfilled any more than a father or a husband. You know, you can't even begin to approach fulfilling the duties of either without being a Christian. Nonetheless, you're under that obligation, and that obligation doesn't change. So it's no more absurd for a Christian to be a magistrate than, you know, to continue the institution of marriage, because it is natural.
So even if you have a completely unregenerate heathen man who is a magistrate, but he's obeying all the laws of God as he's commanded to, that doesn't invalidate his right to magistracy, right? As long as he's obeying the law?
Correct.
Okay. So it's not like the church where the hypocrites aren't even a part of the visible church.
They are, yes, properly speaking, hypocrites are, they are only improperly considered members of the church.
Okay. So even
they are sometimes members of the visible church, but they are only improperly members because we can't discern. But the magistrate, if someone rules according to the law of God, you know, outwardly and so on, then you really have no reason to complain, right? If they're actually ruling according to the law of God. But that's not always going to be the case. In fact, it's very often not the case. Three, because the magistrate exercises and executes God's judgments. Deuteronomy 1:17.
Deuteronomy 1:17. Ye shall not respect persons in judgment, but ye shall hear the small as well as the great. Ye shall not be afraid of the face of man. The judgment is God's, and the cause that is too hard for you, bring it unto me, and I will hear it.
Yeah, the judgment is God's. When a magistrate executes judgment, the judgment is God's. Now, this again raises the question, is that always the case? Well, you could say, providentially, yes. I mean, because providentially, God is bringing to pass whatever he's bringing to pass. But preceptively, no. And should we acquiesce in a judgment that's contrary to the precept of God? Should we be looking to undermine that? And I think there we have to say, no, it can't be. It's not God's judgment. If it's a judgment that is given in contrary to the law of God, it's not. It's not acceptable. It's not legitimate. The reason why the judgments are the judgments of God here in Deuteronomy 1 is because these are people who are just men ruling in the fear of God, if you read the passage. These are men who who are men themselves subject to the commandment of God. They're men of understanding. These are not men who are devoid of any sensibility of the commands of God, who are just passing judgment and then expecting that you and I accept this as a judgment of God. Now that's a problem when we're dealing with unbelievers. You know, particularly when we have people in a country with the light of the gospel, and the church tolerates this. You know, yes, you are getting what you deserve because you tolerate it. You submit to it. You suck it up, and the church by engaging in the way that it has, by this taking this tact of passive obedience, by acquiescing in the political system, which itself is antithetical to the Christian faith. You know, the Constitution of the United States is hostile to Christianity. The Bible says, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me," but everyone who swears an oath to the United States Constitution has another God that they're setting before the true God. And everyone who votes for them is voting for someone to take that oath, you know, by proxy. They're taking the vote, they're taking that oath for you.
The God of pluralism, right?
It's a God of pluralism, it's a God, you know, it's a God who is no God. I mean, there's a sense in which this is an entire undermining of the Christian faith. You know, so by engaging them, you know, it's one thing to petition them; it's another thing to vote for them. By voting for them, you are, by proxy, taking that oath. You're engaged. That's why we won't serve on juries, why we won't serve in the military. It's because of the oath. It's because of the constitution of government. It's not because there's something illegitimate. We're not being held to held up by this idea that there's something illegitimate in the office of magistracy.
Even if there was no oath for joining the military, it would still be wrong to join the military because you're fighting to uphold the laws of the land, correct?
It depends on the laws of the land.
I'm saying that as it is right now.
Yeah, I mean, defending the United States Constitution as it stands is highly problematic. I mean, just at a glance, you know, the First Amendment prohibiting the national establishment of the true religion is enough that every professing Christian should object to that language, and, you know, should swear to have nothing to do with this system as iniquitous. You know, there's never been a nation who had no gods but the United States and France. I think we're the only nations that have actually taken this atheistic position with respect to God. So I know people are upset about this, but it is really the godless constitution. That's not to say that there aren't good things in it. Okay, that there aren't, as has been pointed out by other people, procedurally, that there aren't a number of things that are wise and good. In fact, you know, a lot of the procedural aspects of the federal constitution are based upon Presbyterian church government. You know, Madison was a student of John Witherspoon, and they adopted a lot of that procedure. But they also adopted this stance of agnosticism or atheism with respect to true religion. And that, you know, that's the dead fly that's spoiling the ointment. I mean, if everything about the Constitution was objectionable, you know, no one would support it. But, you know, if you're going to tell a lie that big, that there is no God, you better have a pretty good supporting cast of characters to get people to buy into that. And that's what they've done. So a lot of the U.S. Constitution is you know, from a Christian point of view, is not objectionable. But the omission of God and Christ is highly objectionable and, in fact, absolutely prohibitory. And the fact that the lawmaking of the king is set above the Bible, that's an impediment. Right, 4, because the magistrate receives all things from God which are necessary for the performance of his office. Numbers 11:17.
Numbers 11:17. And I will come down and talk with thee there, and take of the Spirit which is upon thee, and put upon them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with thee. So thou shalt not bear it alone.
Yeah, so again, you know, the ideal case, of course, is when those who are ruling actually have the Spirit of God upon them. Well, you know, that's not going to be unbelievers. I mean, the Bible is really quite favorable to the notion of believers exercising the office of magistracy. The problem is, again, when you have constitutional documents which are standing in the way of this being possible. Right, 5. Because the Lord has promised that magistrates under the gospel shall be nursing fathers through the church.
Isaiah 49:23. And kings shall be thy nursing fathers, and their queens thy nursing mothers. They shall bow down to thee with their face toward the earth, and lick up the dust of thy feet. And thou shalt know that I am the Lord, for they shall not be ashamed that wait for me.
The prophecy regarding the New Testament era is that magistrates will actually be nursing fathers to the church. Well, that, again, shows us that there's not something inherently wrong with this office. You know, it's not the office, it's not the investiture that is the problem. The problem is elsewhere. The problem is going to be, you're going to have to find it somewhere other than in the office. So a Christian is going to be equipped better than anyone else. Christian is going to be better disposed, have better knowledge, better understanding. And there is this promise. Furthermore, they shall make the whore desolate, naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. These magistrates under the gospel. Look at Revelation 17:16.
Revelation 17:16. And the ten horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire.
Yeah, so how do we get to this point? Well, I don't really know how you get from point A to point B, given the fact that it seems to be a catch-22 kind of situation. You know, in order to make war with the beast, you have to be a Christian magistrate. But if you're a Christian, you really can't be a magistrate because of the Constitution as it stands. And we're never under that liberty to do evil that good may come. You know, we may not be able to see how that's going to happen, how that transformation will happen. But we have every reason to believe it will happen, and we have every reason to wait patiently for it, but not to give in.
Isn't that what happened with Constantine back in Rome, where he was converted?
Yeah, well, that's most likely that's what will happen, is we'll actually have some of these people suddenly converted, and they're going to then, I would think, undertake to change a lot of this. You know, you're gonna have people ascend the higher office and then be converted. And that will, in fact, you know, the change, constitutional changes and the fact that you have Christians there, all will add to the restoration of legitimacy. You know, it's not merely the consent of the governed. That's not enough. If the governed they're going to consent to atheism, national atheism, and immorality, and all these other things. What good is their consent? You know, it's better to have a righteous king than to wait around for a righteous bunch of people who are going to change all of that. They're not going to, as long as they acquiesce to these rules. You know, we should, on our end of it, be pushing back and pushing for preceptive government as the legitimate government, particularly over the people of God. You know, we should not be readily accepting and giving a pass to these people out of some notion that we owe them passive obedience. And it's not because, again, that we disavow the legitimacy of magistracy. But there's a difference between allowing the legitimacy of magistracy and saying that that entails every or most magistrates who've existed, you know, since the time of Christ, that they've been legitimate. I think the argument could actually be made that, for the most part, they've been illegitimate. The examples of legitimate magistrates thus far, since the coming of Christ, is great. You know, we have a lot more examples of illegitimate governments.
Were there examples of legitimate governments in the early church era? In those times when there were lawful
Well, I think we have some reason to think that there's legitimacy when we see the rise of Constantine. I know that would probably make a lot of people go out of their minds to hear that, but Constantine does enact on behalf of the church. We have examples in different countries at the time of the Reformation. We have limited examples, and sometimes those examples don't last, you know, for a long time in their respective countries. But we have examples, and we have every reason to believe this is the way it's going to be during the millennium.
What about in nations that are not favored with the light of the gospel, or maybe at let's just take it back to early church period, where, you know, I don't know, Papua New Guinea or something, where it's just out there, and maybe missionaries haven't quite gotten there yet, and there's some system of government hypothetically in place. Is it just an expression of natural law that there's magistrates? Yeah,
there's a legitimacy to them to the degree that they are ruling according to the light of nature. They're going to be imbued. The problem, and this really becomes a problem when you start having nations like Britain, where you have the Solemn League and Covenant, and then that, of course, it's, you know, Britain is making it for themselves and for their colonies. Right? And you can't, after vow, make inquiry. You can't back out of that. Right? So just breaking away from Britain doesn't break a vow that has been made to God, or a covenant that has been undertaken. That changes, that really changes the responsibility of the church, because you have a nation now, you've got nations which have professed that they are aware of the gospel, and that they are responsible not just to the light of nature, but to the precepts of the gospel. And to back away from that, to try to put all of that behind your back and say, okay, now we're going to be this, you know, pluralist, multicultural stew, that is to undermine those very things which were recognized and covenanted. They became matters of covenant to a people. The vast majority of the English-speaking people, you know, fall under this covenant that Britain entered into. And the vast majority of English-speaking people are still aware that they have at least access to the Bible. There may be somebody somewhere, but I suspect, at least within the English-speaking world, it's going to be hard to find. And most nations which speak languages descended from European nations are in a very close moral proximity to those English-speaking. You know, the Anglosphere is huge. I mean, English is the international language. But behind that, these other nations, particularly in Northern Europe, who had adopted Protestantism, they sent wherever they went, wherever you find their languages, they sent knowledge of the Bible. There's no mistaking that. And at the time that they were sending out people, they would send missionaries with them. And so they've carried this knowledge all over the place. And there's a lot higher responsibility because of this. You know, those nations which are only favored with the light of nature, they still have to rule according to the light of nature to be legitimate. You know, but when you've got this extra added level, the standard of legitimacy is raised. Right? It's actually more clear, not less clear, what's required for legitimacy. So it's not just the consent of the governed, however desirable that may be, and it is. But it is it's a matter of a legitimacy that is quantifiable in terms of, you know, access to the Bible. You start passing laws, you know, you embody in your constitution laws contrary to the Bible. And you don't see this push, by the way, among Protestants who believe in this providential, this notion of providential passive obedience. You won't see them talk this way about the Pope, who was the greatest political head of Europe at the time of the Reformation. That was a political leader that, you know, they felt that they could cast off. You know, and you have to wonder, though, when they teach this passive obedience, what do you do if you're a citizen of the Vatican, where the Pope is still, that is, the Antichrist is still the head of the state? Is he legitimate? What do you do with that? I'd like to know, passive obedience people, what you do with that one. But it's still there, and you have to deal with it. Question two. Ought the magistrate in the managing of this office especially to maintain piety, justice, and peace according to the wholesome laws of each commonwealth? Answer, yes. Look at Psalm 2, 10 to 12, Psalm 82, 3 and 4, 2 Samuel 23, 3, and 1 Peter 2, 13.
Psalm 2, verse 10 through 12. Be wise now, therefore, O ye kings, be instructed, ye judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish from the way, when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are all they that put their trust in him.
Psalm 82, verses 3 and 4. Defend the poor and fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and needy. Deliver the poor and needy. Rid them out of the hand of the wicked.
2 Samuel 23, verse 3. The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spake to me, he that ruleth over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God.
In 1 Peter 2, verse 13. Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme.
So the magistrate then has this duty to maintain piety, justice, and peace according to the wholesome laws of each commonwealth. And the confession makes that statement about wholesome laws of each commonwealth because, you know, we don't think that every nation has to adopt the judicial laws of Moses that were given for the nation of Israel as a nation. Although their laws do need to embody the general equity principles. So there can be differences, and there doesn't have to be this absolute lockstep uniformity at every point when it comes to civil law. Right? Civil law is not understood to be a one-size-fits-all proposition like moral law. There may be some people who have a greater propensity to certain kinds of crimes than other people.
What's the difference between civil law and common law? Are they the same thing?
In Britain, in British law, in British history, they're pretty close to the same thing. Common law is the basis for civil law. In most countries that descend from Britain, So the law, a lot of law that ends up getting legislated arises at a local level, and there were just certain certain usages which were always observed among the people, or as long as they can remember, it was done this way or that way, and that a lot of times those things become the basis of civil law.
Is common law kind of like just natural, like light of nature kind of stuff, or is it common courtesy to man?
Well, common law is going to be very much in affinity with light of nature, law of nature. But is it always exactly the same thing? No, because I would suspect that certain aspects, at least of common law, would be changeable given different cultures. The magistrate ought to maintain piety as well as justice and peace. So the apostle exhorts that prayers be made to this end. 1 Timothy 2:2.
1 Timothy 2:2, for kings and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty.
And that division, godliness and honesty, we're talking about, and this is, we're to pray for the magistrate. Now, how can you pray for a magistrate who's not concerned with godliness and honesty? And godliness respects the first table of the law, honesty, the second table of the law. You know, we're being told to pray that they uphold both tables of the law, something that we'll be talking about, as I say, I believe next time. The next two sections are much more concerned with that kind of discussion. Right, rulers are not in their official capacity to be indifferent to godliness any more than to honesty. Both are to be countenanced and promoted by them. Look at Ezra 6:8-10.
Ezra 6:8-10. Moreover, I make a decree what ye shall do to the elders of these Jews for the building of this house of God, that of the king's goods, even of the tribute beyond the river, forthwith expenses be given unto these men, that they be not hindered. And that which they have need of, both young bullocks and rams and lambs for the burnt offerings of the God of heaven, wheat, salt, wine, and oil, according to the appointment of the priests which are at Jerusalem, let it be given them day by day without fail, that they may offer sacrifices of sweet savors unto the God of heaven and pray for the life of the king and of his sons.
All right, so again, the magistrate, we see here again, and we're going to see it again and again. The magistrate that we're talking about is one who is concerned with both tables of the law. And it can't have legitimacy without concern for both tables of the law. You know, at some level, there has to be a concern for both tables of the law. A magistrate who dispenses with anti-blasphemy laws is illegitimate. There's an illegitimacy. You know, he's taking a stance illegitimate. Let me just say, it doesn't mean that we're to disobey just laws. Right? You know, the law was not made for the righteous, but for the unrighteous and the sinner, the wicked. Okay? I mean, we shouldn't balk at that which is according to the keeping of the law. We should want to keep, you know, the moral law as believers. We shouldn't really need that extra stick that is a magistrate beating us over the head.
So when we keep a law that is according to God's law, but is enforced by an immoral authority, we're not obeying out of conscience to the authority, we're obeying out of conscience sake to God, who is...
Correct, and yeah, that's ultimately the only conscience sake that we can obey any governor, all right, any magistrate. We can only obey them for conscience sake to the extent that they are, in fact, legislating according to the law of God. Because that's ultimately, you know, whatsoever is not of faith is sin. What is not according to the moral law of God or the word of God, that's sin.
Where do rules of order fall in under all this?
Order is also a matter of nature. So we're to behave in an orderly way. Christians shouldn't be the ones who are disorderly. You know, Christians shouldn't need a policeman to tell you to stand in line. Right? That's just a matter of order, and it is, again, it is an innate intuition that we need this. And so we're to obey it for conscience sake, because we know we need those kinds of things. Right? But that's not to say that the one who's going to enforce that is an authority, a moral authority, that must be obeyed for conscience sake. Yeah, if we've done wrong, you know, we should acknowledge it. We shouldn't be kicking against the pricks. You know, if we've violated some rubric of order. On the other hand, you know, if they're trying to enforce something clearly wrong, then we should. We should complain.
If an immoral civil government summons you before a court for something that you did that was according to the law of God, but against their immoral law, do you have the? Are you obliged to obey that summons? For example, say you kill an abortion doctor, and they summon you before the court.
Well, they're going to force trial. You to do that. You know,
but but do you have the right? You have the right.
I don't think you should. You know, I don't think in that case you have an obligation to turn yourself in. Okay. You know, like Paul Hill turned himself in. He waited for them to come. I think that was kind of foolish on his part.
If you are lending obedience to an immoral magistrate, and I know it's kind of tricky because, in terms of things where an unlawful or illegitimate magistrate is legislating according to the law of God, even unknowingly, you still need to obey, but you're obeying, like you said, conscience sake, because it's a law of God. When you're obeying an immoral magistrate because of the immoral magistrate for conscience sake, is that just simply
it's
a
idolatry.
Matter?
It's slavish idolatry to a wicked usurpation of power.
Your conscience is obviously erring in that case as well, right?
You have no right to have an erring conscience, but yes, you know, your conscience probably is erring. But this is the problem with these people who are teaching the doctrine of passive obedience. They're causing men's consciences to err. You know, they think that they're sort of slapping something over their conscience to make it to make something more conscionably acceptable. By telling them, you know, just obey. You know, unless they tell you to do something expressly against the word of God, just obey. Well, look, there are those things which are contrary to the word of God. You should obey because it's the word of God, right? You should obey God no matter what. There are those things which pertain to order, you know, traffic lights, generally, okay? But, you know, there's some people who have this doctrine of, because of this doctrine of passive obedience, you're at an intersection at midnight, there's nobody to come for miles, and you're stuck at a red light, and you can see there's nobody coming. Right? Can you go through that? It's really a matter of indifference. I mean, because it's a matter of order. Okay? At that point, there's no safety issue involved. There's no potential violation of the Sixth Commandment. We would be a matter of order, you know, in a city where there's continual flow of traffic. But when you come to two back roads, you know, and a traffic control device, a lot of times now this stuff is arbitrarily set in order to catch you and fine you. You know, if they're going to set up cameras to catch you and things like that. You know, well, that's not only unjust, it's tyrannical. Should we resist that sort of thing? Yeah, we should. But you have to resist a lot of those kind of things in the beginning. You know, if you wait too long to resist, it becomes so pervasive that you would spend your entire life just trying to resist, you know, a traffic light ordinance. And there are, we have to prioritize. You know, we only have so much time.
Now, regarding things such as licenses, like driver's license or license to carry firearms or something, does that fall under order or is that tyranny? Because that's a God-given right, correct?
There could be some argument for order and even public safety with respect to some of this. It's not really that. You know, if you see the people that get driver's licenses, you know, you have to wonder. The people who are issued permits to carry, you have to wonder what the real agenda is. But are you disobeying God if you drive without a license? Of course not. is this some affront to order? Not if you're obeying the law of God and you're behaving in an orderly manner. You know, that of course not.
Now, if it was a lawful moral government that imposed those orders on you as far as licensing, then would you obey for conscience' sake?
Yes.
Okay. So, if it's a lawful government, if it's borderline, like, I don't know if this is right or not, but I'll submit.
Well, let's put it this way. The presumption would be a lawful government is enacting these things as a matter of justice or peace or something, you know, something like that. Probably not a matter of piety, but justice or peace. But that's not what's going on. You know, that's not what's going on now in our present
situation. They're trying to extort money from you for a lot of this.
Well, a lot of it is about taxation. It's just these are various ways of taxing you. And we can, you know, we could expand into that whole realm. I don't really want to get into the realm of taxation today because it is so involved and we only have so much time.
Does the same thing apply to, like, zoning properties? Does the government have the right to tell you what you can and cannot build on the piece of ground that you purchased?
Right. You want to know who gave us zoning laws?
Yes.
The Vatican. They came out of Romanism. they arose out of Romanism, Roman theology. So, you know, zoning laws are artificial constraints that are put on property. And a lot of this, you know, I know there are a lot of people who think this is just unnecessary for us to talk about these kinds of things. But zoning laws, like property tax, are part of an agenda by the powerful to make it virtually impossible for common people to have property. You know, they are power grabs, and so they're really, you know, zoning laws are very often actually violations of the commandment, thou shalt not steal. Mm-hmm. All right? What they're doing is they're robbing you of the use of your property or of the value of your property or of the ability to own property through zoning law. And that is wrong. That's tyrannical.
One more quick question. say a person has a house on top of like a natural resource that they just discovered, and it's a necessity, like the, this country, this state needs the oil underneath this house, but the person is just some bullheaded person who just won't sell their house.
Yeah, they're gonna declare this eminent domain, and they're gonna take your property.
But does the state have the right to do that for some instances?
Eminent domain?
Yeah, like it if the common good needs it.
If you have a legitimate government and they are studying justice and peace, I'm not going to say that in no case could they declare eminent domain. Okay? However, again, most of the time, if you look at what lies behind eminent domain, it was not driven by some genuine public need. It was driven by some corporate entity's desire to have access to a piece of property at the expense of the present owner of the property, you know, or a discounted rate. So, I mean, there are a lot of issues like that. And, you know, again, the magistrate very easily can transgress. This is exactly why the magistrate really should not be involved in making a lot of these kinds of decisions.
And that's where Ahab and Jezebel sinned when they took Naboth's vineyard, right? It was unlawful.
It's an unlawful taking. And very often, this exercise of eminent domain is an unlawful taking. Right? There isn't really any compelling public good that would so far outweigh the right of the private owner. You know, ultimately, everything belongs to God. And so that's why I would say you can't just dismiss eminent domain. I don't think this libertarian notion that, you know, private property rights is absolute under all circumstances, that's not exactly correct. Because, you know, you and I, we're not God. Mm-hmm. Right? But on the other hand, God has distributed property and has made it distributable. And if we just look at the land laws in Israel, the principle of general equity, we should understand that everyone has a right to own a portion of property. Everyone has a right to have something you can call your own. And to an extent, that can't be infringed. I mean, it's the point of the Jubilee year. You know, even if you sell it off 50 years down the road, for whenever that Jubilee year comes, you get to redeem it. You get to get it back.
So is renting out apartments almost like usury? Because it's not really the person's own. They're paying the person who owns the property to live there for a while. It's not technically theirs, right?
That's a different situation. Property tax, I think, is a violation of the idea that you can own property. Hmm. Right? I mean, it's one of the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto. You can look it up. But that's you know, again, it's a deliberate attempt to undercut your right and ability to have and own property, and use property. Right. Last question. Question three. May the civil magistrate now under the New Testament wage war upon just and necessary occasions? The answer is yes, again, Romans 13:4.
Praise the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is a minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil.
Yeah, so the magistrate's not prohibited from exercising judicial homicide. That is, this idea, and this I think is something we have to discuss briefly before we move on to the issue of war. This notion that, you know, the magistrate can't execute people, that there's something unchristian about capital punishment. There's not. All right? he has the power of the sword, and that the sword, the language of the sword connotes a sword that was used for beheading, which is one of the very common ways that the, you know, the Romans did, for example, execute people. You know, he has that power. He has that authority. Right? So it's judicial homicide. It is homicide, but it's judicial. It's lawful homicide. Thou shalt not kill is speaking to unlawful homicide. Right? Homicide outside of the law or apart from the law. But, you know, when God has decreed that certain things are worthy of death, then certainly they remain worthy of death. God has said specifically of murder that it requires death. You can't, no magistrate has a right to dispense with capital punishment in the case of murder, capital murder.
But in extraordinary circumstances, do they have the right to defer it? Like if say this guy has some national secret and he's going to blab it to the whole world. Do you have some situation like that? Do you have the right?
I think you'd want to execute him quicker.
Well, I said the wrong thing. I meant to say he's the only person with some kind of knowledge that you need for your country to, you know, to survive, and he's committed some kind of death penalty offense. Does the common good of the people prohibit the magistrate in that instance from executing the death penalty on that person because he has some kind of information? No,
the magistrate doesn't have the right to dispense with the death penalty, particularly in the case of murder. Mm. Right. Now they have leeway. Other crimes, in the most aggravated form, can call for capital punishment. Right, but murder, capital murder, first-degree murder, that demands, because there's this issue of blood guiltiness. Mm. We're never to do evil, the good may come. And it is good to execute someone who has murdered someone else. So the magistrate is not prohibited from exercising judicial homicide, for unto him is committed the sword, for the purpose of avenging evil, whether individual or corporate. Again, Romans 13:4 and 1 Peter 2:14.
Romans 13:4, for he is the minister of God to thee for good, but if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil.
1 Peter 2:14, or unto governors, as unto them that are sent by him for punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of them that do well.
And we should also say this does not pertain only to the heathen. Again, as some of the Anabaptists thought, because it is those higher powers or moral authorities, as they're ordained by God, which are contemplated in this exercise. Again, Romans 13:1,
let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God.
And we can say that this public right is not opposed either by the command of God, which respects private persons. For example, Matthew 5:39,
but I say unto you that you resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also.
Yeah, or by Christian charity, which can love the persons and punish the crimes. Look at Joshua 7:25 and Acts 5:3-4.
Joshua 7:25, and Joshua said, why hast thou troubled us? The Lord shall trouble thee this day. And all Israel stoned him with stones, and burned them with fire. After them he stoned them with stones. Acts 5:3-4. But Peter said, Ananias, why hath Satan filled thine heart to lie to the Holy Ghost, and to keep back part of the price of the land? Whiles it remained, was it not thine own? And after it was sold, was it not in thine own power? Why hast thou conceived this thing in thine heart? Thou hast not lied unto men, but unto God.
Okay, so, you know, we're not saying, I mean, this position is not contrary to, you know, God, or Jesus saying, turn the other cheek, right? That's an individual command. The magistrate, whose job it is to resist evil, that he doesn't have the right to turn the other cheek. He doesn't have the right to turn the other cheek for you. Now again, in cases where less than first degree murder, where, for example, the person offended is more inclined to leniency, then the magistrate has more room to be lenient because, you know, you are turning the other cheek. But the magistrate, as the magistrate, does not have the right to turn the other cheek for you. Right. Magistrate has the right to consider all factors involved and to judge accordingly. But one of the things that they really can't do is they can't turn the other cheek. They can't simply say, well, I forgive you. It's not within their right to do that. Right, nor is it opposed by prophecy concerning the wolf dwelling with the lamb, which refers not to the duty of magistrates, but to believers. Isaiah 11:6.
Isaiah 11, verse 6, the wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them.
Yeah, nor is it opposed by the words of Christ, resist not evil, which again treats only of private vengeance, not public. Matthew 5, 39 and 40.
Matthew 5, 39 and 40. But I say unto you that you resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also, and if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also.
And for people who can't see how you can separate the person from the office, I think you have a real problem with these kinds of verses that Jesus is, you know, where Jesus is commanding this sort of thing. It's that very inability to separate the providential and the preceptive that has made Anabaptists so opposed to the office of magistracy and to think that it really only pertains to the heathen to have such a thing. Because no Christian as magistrate could ever exercise that office because, you know, he's doing it as a Christian. I mean, he's, you know, and as a Christian, he has to forgive and resist not evil and so on.
In some of these Anabaptistic societies where they resist, where they didn't agree with the whole, you know, they didn't have any laws or any magistrates, who enforced the punishments among them? Were they enforced by private citizens on each other?
No, Anabaptists don't generally, they're parasitic societies. They're not, you know, there's like no nation has ever become the Anabaptist nation. The closest we've ever had to that is the state of Rhode Island. Thank you, Roger Williams. And all of the tolerationist principles, you know, were really warmed and hatched from all those Anabaptists in Rhode Island. I mean, you know, we end up getting saddled with that thanks to a lot of their influence in the United States. You know, the United States is in that sense an Anabaptist culture. But there's been a conflict going on since the beginning between that Anabaptistic strain and more of a magisterial reformational point of view, and since the 19th century, you know, popery's been here. All right, thus we can say then the Quakers, Anabaptists, Socinians, and Ermingtonians, all together unlawful, now under the New Testament, to wage war. You know, They just don't see the need for the magistrate, and they really find problem with waging of war. But they're confuted for the following reasons. One, is God appointed and commanded lawful war under the Old Testament. Get Numbers 31, 2.
Numbers 31, verse 2. Avenge the children of Israel, of the Midianites. Afterward shalt thou be gathered unto thy people.
It said the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon when he was to fight the battles of the Lord against the Midianites and the Amalekites in Judges 6:34.
Judges 6:34. The Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, and Abiezer was gathered after him.
So, the fact is, God has commanded, he's appointed lawful war under the Old Testament, and that lawful war is conducted by the power of the Spirit, according to the rules that God has set forth. He prescribes a manner and way of making war. If you look at Numbers 10, as well as Numbers 31, 27, Deuteronomy 20, verse 2. Numbers 10, just read a few, first 10 verses or so. Get a sense.
Numbers 10 to verse 10. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, make thee two trumpets of silver, of a whole piece shalt thou make them, that thou mayest use them for the calling of the assembly and for the journeying of the camps. And when they shall blow with them, all the assembly shall assemble themselves to thee at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And if they blow but with one trumpet, then the princes, which are heads of the thousands of Israel, shall gather themselves unto thee. When ye blow an alarm, then the camps that lie on the east part shall go forward. When ye blow an alarm the second time, then the camps that lie on the south side shall take their journey. They shall blow an alarm for their journeys. But when the congregation is to be gathered together, ye shall blow, but ye shall not sound an alarm. And the sons of Aaron, the priests, shall blow with trumpets, and they shall be to you for an ordinance forever throughout your generations. And if you go to war in your land against the enemy that oppresseth you, then ye shall blow an alarm with the trumpets, and ye shall be remembered before the Lord your God, and ye shall be saved from your enemies. Also in the day of your gladness, and in your solemn days, and in the beginnings of your months, ye shall blow with the trumpets over your burnt offerings, and offer the sacrifices of your peace offerings, that they may be to you for a memorial before your God. I am the Lord your God.
Numbers 31, verse 27. And divide the prey into two parts, between them that took the war upon them, who went out to battle, and between all the congregation.
Deuteronomy 20, verse 2. And it shall be, when ye are come nigh unto the battle, that the priests shall approach and speak unto the people.
So we know then that God is telling, he tells them how to make war, what they're to do, and so on. He gives knowledge and skill to his generals and heroes to fight his own battles. Look at Psalm 18:34 and 144:1.
Psalm 18, verse 34, he teacheth my hands to war, so that a bow of steel is broken by mine arms.
Psalm 144, verse 1, blessed be the Lord my strength, which teacheth my hands to war and my fingers to fight.
So again, all of this in the Old Testament, all of which is nowise abrogated under the New Testament, according to Christ himself. Look at Matthew 5, 17 and 18.
Matthew 5, verses 17 and 18. Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law, till all be fulfilled.
Right. Second, because the centurion that was converted to the faith didn't lay down his office of a captain of 100, which surely he would have done if to war under the New Testament had been unlawful. Acts 10, 1, 2, and 47.
Acts 10, verses 1 and 2. There was a certain man in Caesarea called Cornelius, a centurion of the band called the Italian Band, a devout man and one that feared God with all his house, which gave much alms to the people and prayed to God alway. And verse 47. Can any man forbid water, that these should not be baptized, which have received the Holy Ghost as well as we?
And the same could be said of the believing centurion in Matthew 8, 8-10.
Matthew 8,
verses 8 through 10. The centurion answered and said, Lord, I am not worthy that thou shouldest come under my roof, but speak the word only, and my servant shall be healed. For I am a man having authority, I am a man under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to this man, go, and he goeth, and to another, come, and he cometh, and to my servant, do this, and he doeth it. When Jesus heard it, he marveled and said unto them that followed, Verily I say unto you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel.
Okay, so, you know, here's a case where you have early Christians, Christian converts, who are in the Roman military. Well, they're converted, they're in the military, they're not required to get out, they're not required to take, you know, there's no requirement here that they're going to be taking other oaths, and in fact, what they're told to do is to do what's right. I mean, the admonition is to do just that, seek piety, justice, peace. And as long as they're following after that, you know, the Romans, when you were in this kind of position, you had a lot of leeway to do that sort of thing. They were not micromanaging, and you were in fact not bound up by some constitutional document that was going to prohibit you from doing what was right. You were actually entrusted with a great degree of liberty in maintaining your post. And so in these cases, presumably they're able to bend their post to do what is acceptable. I mean, they're told that's what they need to do. A third, because the office of a soldier is not reprehended and reproved by John the Baptist, but rather proven when he sanctioned military discipline by laws. Luke 3:14.
And the soldiers likewise demanded of him, saying, And what shall we do? And he said unto them, Do violence to no man, neither accuse any falsely, and be content with your wages.
Right. So, again, you know, the same sort of thing. He's told to obey the law of God and to do his duty in accordance with the law of God. As long as that can be maintained, what he does is acceptable. And fourth, because opposition, defense against unjust violence, which oftentimes cannot be done without war, is the very law of nature. And thus we see in Genesis 14, 1 through 9.
Genesis 14, verses 1 through 9. And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Kedor, Lamar, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations, that these made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shimeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar. All these were joined together in the Vale of Siddim, which is the Salt Sea. 12 years served they Kedor Limer, and in the 13th year they rebelled. And in the 14th year came Kedor Limer, the king, and the kings that were with him, and smote the Rephaims in Ashtaroth, Karnaim, and the Zuzims in Ham, and Emims in Shavak, Kir Atham, and the Horites in their Mount Seir unto El Paran, which is by the wilderness. And they returned and came to Enmishpat, which is Kadesh, and smote all the country of the Amalekites, and also the Amorites that dwelt in Hazazon Tamar. And there went out of the king of Sodom, and the king of Gomorrah, and the king of Admah, and the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, the same as Zoar. And they joined battle with them in the Vale of Siddim, with Kedor Lamar, the king of Elam, and with Tidal, king of nations, and Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of LSR, four kings with five.
So war has been around for a long time. It is a law of nature. And as a law of nature, and this is a point, grace does not negate nature. Grace elevates nature, but does not negate it. So it's something which is, according to the law of nature, it is something moral and perpetual. It's not something that's going to be done away with under the New Testament, but it will, its use and purpose will be elevated. And that's not only war, but we can say that of marriage. We can also say that of magistracy. Fifth, because it is foretold that the kings of the earth shall make war against the beast, Revelation 17, 14 and 16.
Revelation 17, 14 and 16. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is the Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called, and chosen, and faithful. Verse 16. And the ten horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire.
Okay, so again, the overarching point is that the New Testament does not abrogate the right to make war on just and necessary occasion. It's lawful for magistrates to do so. It's particularly lawful for Christian magistrates to do so. And that is the point. Now, there are things which it is not lawful for Christian magistrates to do, such as dispensing sacraments. On the other hand, they do have an obligation to suppress blasphemy and idolatry. They have an obligation to call synods when they need to know what to do, when they need counsel, and so on. Those are going to be the topics we're going to take up in the next section.